It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. The International Seafood Sustainability Foundation was founded in 2009 as a joint effort between seafood industry leaders, scientists, and environmental nonprofits like the World Wildlife Foundation to ensure effective conservation and management of tuna fishing resources globally. The organization is celebrating 10 years this spring, and Butler County native and foundation president Susan Jackson has been there for it all. Susan, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
You grew up here in Western Pennsylvania, not historically known for its ties to the seafood industry. How did you get into that field?
Well, nothing actually made sense about my resume until this job. I was actually a lawyer and then went to the Hines Law Department, and Hines owned Starkist at the time. So wound my way through corporate life for a while, and then Starkist was one of the founders of ISSF. So I moved from Starkist over to this role.
What gaps did you see then in sustainable fishing practices that ISSF fills today?
So tuna are special because they swim the whole way across an ocean. So unlike a lot of things, one country, or with some fisheries, one state, can't manage it all. So with tunas, they have to be managed by international treaty bodies, and they had been doing that. But right before ISSF got started, they stopped being as effective as they had been. Treaty bodies have to work by unanimous consensus, so any country could block something. And one in particular had met and failed 7 times in a row to pass a management measure that the scientists said absolutely needed to be passed. You have a problem with consensus. You have a problem with every country is representing its constituency, and you have different constituencies. And the tuna industry just really felt that this was a problem that we could do better following scientific advice and getting all the industry and the NGOs on the same page, so that all those countries, when they sat down to manage tunas, were hearing a more consistent message urging them to do what the scientists were saying.
In the beginning, why focus primarily on the conservation of tuna compared to other seafoods?
Mm-hmm. Tuna is very highly migratory. So they have this special management system where it involves a lot of countries. And secondly, tuna was in a sweet spot where it is global, but there aren't that many companies that are active in the processing and the marketing of tuna. So when ISSF started, we had 8 companies, but 8 companies represented major purchasers of every species of tuna from every ocean, except bluefin, in the world, and was still about half of the tuna purchased every year. So you could make meaningful impact without so many voices at the table that you'd never get up and running.
So you started with 8, up to 30 today, including a founding member, Starkist.
Correct.
Have you had any growing pains in the past 10 years?
Yes.
What are those challenges like?
So ISSF is this partnership of industry and scientists and environmental nonprofits organizations. And I like to say we're like a water balloon. So when anybody pushes on one side, something pops out on the other side. But that's good. You have that healthy tension. But when I look back at what we thought we had to do 10 years ago, we nailed it. Like, we had the right theory of change. We had the right partners and we had the right work streams. That hasn't changed in 10 years. What's changed is we had to go a lot deeper on all of them that I think anybody thought we would 10 years ago.
What do your current conservation efforts look like?
I talked a little bit at the beginning about regional fishery management organizations. We absolutely believe that that's who has to manage tunas. You know, there is definitely a very important and necessary role for governments to listen to their scientists, decide what needs to be done, and then enforce it in their waters and with their vessels. But because it has to be consensus-based, you have a problem with political will. So ISSF's theory of change is to help the RFMOs do what they need to do and to be stronger. So it's things like providing more data to the scientists so that their scientific advice can be better. So we don't want to supplant them or take over the role of governments. Absolutely not. It's about helping the governments do what they need to do and get that political will faster.
Can you explain that RFMO process a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. So the UN, the United Nations. That's something that listeners would be familiar with. And, you know, that's like 200 countries.
Certainly.
But the process is basically the same. You get all the countries together who have a legitimate interest. And in a fishery, that would mean every country that has a coastline in the region that you're talking about, or they're called distant water fishing nations, countries from elsewhere that have fleets fishing there. And so however many that is, 16, 30, 60, depending upon the region, first they negotiate what the bounds of what they're going to manage is going to be about, and that would be the treaty. And then they implement that treaty. And that's what the Regional Fisheries Management Organization does. So it listens to scientists, it listens to other experts, it listens to member states saying, we think you need to limit the tuna catch to X number of tons, or limit, don't allow fishing in these certain months, or require this type of data to be supplied so that the scientists can get the right data and we can make sure everybody's been complying.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris talking to Susan Jackson, a native Pittsburgher and president of the International Seafood Sustainability Foundation. I'm curious, Susan, so you sounds like the process, you begin with a challenge or an opportunity. Maybe you find some research-based facts that you can distribute to your organizations. What does the process look like from there? How do you affect change long-term?
So one of the things that we expect ISSF participating companies to do is also to reach out to their governments, because within our participating companies, somebody's employing a lot of people in almost every country that's sitting at one of those treaty meetings. So historically, the vessel owners have been really good at talking to their governments. And so part of our theory of change is bringing other voices, other businesses, other meaningful employers in countries to be talking to those same governments, saying, no, we really think you need to do this. And the more voices that are saying this to more governments, it makes it easier to get that unanimous agreement to do it.
So have you had any large-scale success yet? Just looking at some of the goals on the ISSF website, reduce overfishing, stop illegal fishing, promote responsible harvesting practices, reduce the number of fish that need to be caught and discarded at sea, called bycatch in the industry. How do you manage all those great big goals all at once?
So I'll give you three examples of kind of where things were on three different topics when we started and where they are today. The first one is, if you think of a car and a car has a VIN number, that, you know, unique number that's assigned to your car that never ever leaves it. Well, boats can get one of those. It's just that fishing boats didn't have to. So in 2011, ISSF said, if you want to sell to an ISSF participating company, you need to get one. And at that point in time, no tuna RFMOs were requiring the boats to have that unique number. Today, over 90% of the fishing boats have them, and every RFMO requires that a boat has that number. So that's a very practical example. If you look at, there's a management technique or tool for fisheries called harvest strategies and harvest control rules. When we started, no tuna stock had them. Today, one has a full suite of every component of a harvest strategy, and every other RFMO has made significant progress and enacted many steps along the way of a harvest strategy.
How has technology changed the game when you're referring to fisheries and how you manage these things on a global scale?
Technology is really the friend of fisheries, and it can improve or change fisheries in three ways. Number one, it increases fishing efficiency, which can be good. It's good from a, you know, fuel and environmental use perspective, but it could be bad because it means you're going to catch more fish with the same amount of effort. Number two, it increases fishing selectivity. So it used to be that a boat could use a device called an eco sounder, and if they were good, they could say, yeah, we think there's some fish there, but that's all they would know. But now, getting really close to being able to say what kind of fish. And that will be very meaningful to help the fishery become more selective. So you're only fishing those species that you're targeting and that are potentially the most resilient. But then lastly, it helps monitoring as well, because you could have all the best management in place for a fishery, but if you're not sure that it's actually happening, and those rules aren't being respected, then it's meaningless. And technology's also helping to greatly improve monitoring of fisheries.
Is there any way to work with a bad actor, maybe someone who isn't abiding by approved best practices from your perspective?
Absolutely. I think everybody has the right to get smarter. And that's how I look at it. I also think a lot of times we all need to take responsibility that a bad actor only exists because a market exists for their product. First of all, we can all try to make sure that the market doesn't exist by our buying decisions, but then also get their business interests to align and show them what they need to do to improve.
Yeah. So is the weight of that on consumers then?
Oh, not the weight of it, but you know, they're not irrelevant, that's for sure.
What do you think would be the cost if we gave up seafood sustainability and just let fisheries or distributors control the market all on their own?
Well, with a lot of fisheries and tuna specifically, it's not just the question of what the developed country markets are doing. And that's an important question, and that definitely helps lead the sustainability. But it's a matter of food security, and it's a matter of economic security for coastal countries. So, you know, you have real human interest in keeping fisheries healthy. Tuna fisheries we're fortunate that they're very resilient. So if you just manage them properly, they'll take care of themselves. They rebound very quickly. And it would be, you know, really a waste if you let that resource not manage itself. It takes some doing, but it's definitely worth doing. And it's not only for the developed countries to have seafood in their markets and their grocery stores, but it's for people living in coastal countries and island countries to have food and to have jobs.
So you grew up here in Pittsburgh. You founded ISSF here in Pittsburgh. Why not move to somewhere with a coastline, somewhere close to these markets that you talk about?
Well, tuna are tropical and they're global. So I can be anywhere because chances are I'm always going to need to be somewhere else. And you know, this is it.
Susan, how can people listening do more to encourage sustainable seafood practices?
You just need to ask. You need to start asking intelligent questions about the seafood that you're eating, because the people that you're buying it from won't care until their customers care. And then that will trickle the whole way up the supply chain. And the more people that care about, the faster things change.
Susan Jackson is president of the International Seafood Sustainability Foundation. Susan, congratulations on the organization's first 10 years, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, the Commonwealth Court has ruled that it cannot extend the relationship between UPMC doctors and customers insured through Highmark. Then, a local group is trying to help women find new jobs and even new career paths with a few cups of coffee. Hear from PA Women Work about finding sustainable employment with the help of a mentor. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Mick Stinelli. Southwestern Pennsylvania is the latest of 16 markets to get a car vending machine. Online car retailer Carvana likens itself to the Amazon of used cars. The facility just off I-79 in Bridgeville is equipped with a lift that can grab each car off a platform and present it to the new owner to drive home. Port Authority of Allegheny County launched a new website this week in an effort to make its customer service as mobile as its vehicles. Customers can plan trips with a Google Maps integration, and eventually there will be a chat feature to text with service representatives. A mobile app is expected out later this year. Find out more at our website, wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. The Commonwealth Court has ruled that it cannot extend the relationship between UPMC doctors and customers insured through Highmark. A 2014 consent decree ensured certain patients with Highmark insurance would continue getting in-network care from UPMC health providers, but it's set to expire June 30th, leaving many to decide, do they stay with Highmark insurance or do they change insurance companies to continue receiving their UPMC care? Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro is trying to extend that consent decree indefinitely. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden joins us now to discuss this latest twist in the UPMC Highmark saga. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Megan.
So remind us, how did this dispute start?
I guess you could kind of say it goes back to 2012, really, when UPMC decided that it would no longer accept Highmark insurance. And then in 2014, this consent decree was created that now expires in a couple months, really.
So why did Judge Robert Simpson rule this week that the consent decree could not be extended?
He wrote that because the Supreme Court already decided that the date for the consent decree expiring was June 30th, 2019, he lacks the authority to change that, even if it were in the public interest to do so.
Talking about that public interest, all of this kind of goes back to their nonprofit status, UPMC's nonprofit status. Can you explain that a little bit?
So what Shapiro contends is that UPMC is abusing its nonprofit status. They have executives that are making million-dollar salaries, and they're building hospitals in other parts of the world, and they're not really using their tax-exempt status to benefit people here in Western Pennsylvania.
By, quote-unquote, turning away Highmark patients?
Yes.
So if this was struck down by the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court, the second highest court in the state, does this mean that Attorney General Shapiro can take it to the state Supreme Court?
He told me, or a spokesperson for his office told me, that that is what the Attorney General plans to do.
So what happens if he does make that appeal to the court?
Well, the court can decide whether or not they want to take the appeal up. My guess is that they will. What I'm really interested in waiting for is whether or not the Supreme Court will issue a stay to extend the consent decree until oral arguments can be heard.
When we say a stay, do we have any idea how long that might be?
I have no idea.
And if a stay is issued ultimately, do we have any idea if it would have staying power, if Highmark patients would be able to remain with their UPMC providers indefinitely?
That's something I don't know either. Who knows what the court will do? I'm excited to find out.
So in the meantime, how did UPMC and Highmark react to the news this week?
UPMC simply said that they agreed that the Commonwealth Court lacks the authority to extend the consent decree. And Highmark says it supports the Attorney General's efforts to try and get UPMC to accept Highmark customers or its consumers at its hospitals and doctor's offices.
What about you? What to you is the most significant part, or maybe the most significant thing to follow about Judge Simpson's ruling this week?
Well, this is very much part of the process that we expected would happen when Shapiro filed his legal action back in February. However, I thought it was pretty interesting reading Judge Simpson's memorandum that he thought it was within the Attorney General's legal authority to regulate public charities. And so I'm excited to see how the court, be it the Commonwealth Court or the Supreme Court, interprets what is and is not a charity and whether UPMC is abusing its tax-exempt status as Shapiro alleges.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. Starting a new job or pursuing a new career can be difficult when the paths to mentorship or training are unclear. Here in Pittsburgh, the group Pennsylvania Women Work is hoping to help forge those connections for people looking for sustainable employment, all over a few cups of coffee. Susan Showalter-Booker is Director of Programs at Pennsylvania Women Work, and Tanisha Williams is the Program Manager for the Three Cups of Coffee program. Welcome to you both to The Confluence.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Megan.
Thank you for having us.
Tanisha, since you're the program manager, give us a quick rundown on what Three Cups of Coffee is all about.
So Three Cups of Coffee is a short-term mentoring program. We have volunteer mentors who meet with job seekers for 3 one-hour cups of coffee. We have a partnership with Crazy Mocha, so they generously provide free coffee and their locations for these meetings to happen. And during these three meetings, a mentor can help a job seeker to address whatever their barriers are to getting employment.
Who are the usual clients, and what are the typical challenges they face in that search for sustainable employment?
So a typical job seeker can be a woman who is unemployed, underemployed, feeling a little stuck in her career, unhappy in her career, and really wanting to transition into a new field or to gain employment. And during those three meetings, some of the challenges might be she's applying to jobs but not getting interviews. So maybe she needs to work on her resume, work on her cover letter, work on identifying, applying to the appropriate jobs. Or maybe she is getting the interviews but aren't getting job offers. So a mentor can really help to help her to identify what might be the barriers during the interview process. Or it might be an individual who is new to Pittsburgh or who has been at a job sector for many years and is now transitioning. So maybe she needs help expanding her professional network or even learning how to get into that new job sector.
Who are the mentors?
So a mentor can be is usually an established professional who is wanting to give back in a very meaningful way without the long-term commitment and who is wanting to be a corporate advocate, help to open doors for her job seeker, and really just helping an individual to re-enter the workforce.
And what about the mentees? Where do you find them and how do they find you?
So we find the mentees in many ways. So they may come in from one of our other programs that we offer. We do a lot of recruitment through marketing, social media, events like this, where we're kind of spreading the word through word of mouth. We may have mentors who might refer individuals that they know who are seeking employment, or a mentee who had a great experience and now she's kind of sharing her experience with other individuals.
So what does that great experience look like? What does it feel like? How do you want them to leave feeling more empowered?
So for a job seeker, a lot of times when an individual is unemployed, their confidence sometimes really start to, they start to really feel discouraged with their job search. And when they're meeting with a professional in their desired job sector, that mentor can really help to empower that individual, help them to regain the confidence that they're lacking. When you're meeting with someone who can really say, you just need a little bit of a push, you know, they start to feel like, oh, I can do this. Or, you know, we start to see them transform in really remarkable ways.
Susan, from your perspective, how does a program like Three Cups of Coffee align with Pennsylvania Women's Work, their broader mission?
Well, so our broader mission is to inspire, empower, and prepare women during career transition. And that's exactly what Three Cups of Coffee does.
And what is the organization at large? What are more of your mission? What is more of what you do?
Well, we work with women at various points in life, depending on where they're at, we will meet them along that path and then provide tools at that point. So, for instance, we work with clients such as single parents, underemployed, unemployed workers, as well as refugees. And each one of our programs has a turn towards those unique barriers that those clients face. And so what we do is we have a toolbox, basically, that we create that we're able to give assistance during that time and also to help with job placement.
How does the Three Cups of Coffee program enhance that mission?
So again, our mission is really to empower women. So when a woman is meeting with an established professional, that mentor is really helping to address a lot of the barriers that they're facing. It's one of the tools in that toolbox that Susan just talked about. Again, helping really to give them that little push, empower them, and get them into financial stable positions and jobs.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris talking to a couple of professionals from Pennsylvania Women Work about how mentorship and a cup of coffee can help land sustainable employment. I'm curious, how do mentees become involved in the program and how do you track maybe over time whether the program is successful?
So a mentee, they go through a screening because I want to be sure that they are work ready and they're eligible for the program. If they're not, they're referred to one of our other career development programs. There is an application process. They do an in-person interview with me because I want to be sure that I really understand what their career goals are, because all of the data that I collect during the interview and the applications, what I use to be sure that I'm matching them with the right mentor who can truly help them and to address whatever their needs and barriers are. And then once they're matched with the mentor, they meet for the 3 1-hour cups of coffee. During the meetings, each individual, the mentor and the mentees, they submit forms so that I'm informed on how the meetings are going, what their progress is. And then I follow up with my job seekers 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year later just to track their success and to continue to offer support. If they're not working, we continue to follow them until they've achieved their goals.
Tanisha, how do you make those matches? How do you know who would be a right fit for who?
Again, it's through that application and the interview. I take lots of notes. I'm getting all of the information that I need. Mentors also go through an application. They do an interview with me, and I'm collecting the mentor's background. So I have the background of each individual, the mentors and the mentees. And all of the data that I've collected is what I'm using to be sure that the matches are the right match. So I'm always matching individuals in the right job with similar job sectors or industries.
So whether it's Three Cups of Coffee or Pennsylvania Women Work more broadly, how do you measure success? What does success look like? And do you have any examples of that?
So success looks like if we're getting an individual who's unemployed, if she's moving into employment with a living wage, that is a success. If it's an individual who is underemployed, getting a better job, making more money, having benefits, that's a success. Or an individual from one of our other programs who might have came into our program not really sure what she wants to do, leaving there with a career plan, with a goal, going into new education programs can also be success. So success can look different for different individuals depending on where they are.
You mentioned a lot about goals. Do you ever find that some of the folks that come into the program or are interested in the program maybe aren't sure of those career goals, and that's part of the discovery process?
So if they're not sure of their career goals, then we have other career programs like our New Choices program that can really help them to go through some modules, 10 modules, to identify what those goals are. Once they've identified their career goals, then they can come into the Three Cups of Coffee program, where they can then be matched with a mentor to help them now really achieve the goals.
So mentees gain all this valuable feedback and help with networking. How do the mentors help benefit from the program?
Mentors can benefit because they're able to give back to the community in a very meaningful way. They're able to really to gain professional development through helping an individual. And they're giving access to, they're also being connected with individuals that they probably would never meet without this mentorship opportunity.
Do you ever find the passion either from maybe the mentor, kind of giving back, or from the mentee, just trying to look ahead to the future, kind of inspiring? The passion?
So we have mentees who, once they've completed the program, they then become mentors. So they're also starting to give back in a very meaningful way because of the passion. They're passionate about the mission of the program, so they want to continue to give back.
So do we have any idea what the outcomes might be for folks that aren't maybe able to hook up with a good mentor or find a program like this? What happens outside of a program that's more established?
I don't think that actually we have the data on that. What we do have is that our placement rate currently for Three Cups of Coffee is 82%. And so we find that there is a difference with that, and also that the graduates of this program also tend to go into a position at a higher wage rather than those that go in on their own.
Do you have ideals for what that should look like, what those wages should look like, what those positions could be?
In the Three Cups of Coffee?
So the positions vary. I have clients who are looking for that first entry-level position. It might be a new graduate out of undergrad or right out of grad school, or it could be that professional who is more established in her career looking for a more executive level. So it's a very wide range of positions that individuals are looking for, and those salary ranges and require expectations. They can vary.
So the Three Cups of Coffee program lasts 3 official sessions, but do you ever find that the mentees and mentors stay in touch after the program is over?
We find that a lot, more often than not. Mentors will follow their mentees up until that individual is working, or they just formed a really great relationship. And there are times where the mentees are hired at the mentor's place of work, and they meet for lunch, and they become, friends, and they really form a great relationship. So we see that often. Or the mentors may invite the mentee to stay in touch, and they will continue to meet regularly.
Do either of you find that there's anything unique to the female job-seeking perspective that mentorship really lends itself to?
So we find that sometimes women have a harder time tapping into their professional network, asking for help, and just asking an individual to meet with them just to kind of brainstorm. We find that because women have such a harder time doing that, we're trying to create that space where they feel safe, and it's comfortable and it's natural, and helping them so that they can, in the future, even when they are working, to continue to build that professional network. So we want to teach them how to kind of put those tools in their toolbox for the future.
Yes. And we've also found that when they step outside of work, maybe to stay home and raise the children, they're entering back in, that in that process, sometimes they lose their ability to remember who they are professionally. Mm-hmm. And sometimes joining into a group like ours and being able to rediscover that, it makes all the difference.
And very briefly, Tanisha, where can folks find you?
So we are located downtown at the Center City Towers on Smithfield Street. And if they're interested, they can check out our website at www.pawomenwork.org, or they can call me at 412-904-1345.
Susan Showalter Booker and Tanisha Williams are the facilitators of the Three Cups of Coffee program through Pennsylvania Women Work. Thanks so much to you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, it's been nearly 5 years since a stabbing attack took place at Franklin Regional High School. Since then, Superintendent Gennaro Perino has been appointed to a state committee to propose new ways to keep students safe. We'll talk to him about his approach to safety and how he tries to focus outside attention on better education for the district's students. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zankovich, and Alex Lenigan. I am the editor and producer of The Confluence. Kevin Gavin will be back with you on Monday. I'm Megan Harris. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.